Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 30th. We get the latest on the Hawaii Tourism Authority. Will board members resign as the governor asked? It's been called a hot mess. We learn about the government shutdown of a suicide prevention hotline dedicated to the LGBTQ community and what it means for those who rely on it. We hear about dune restoration efforts on Maui that incorporates native plants. From seed to shoreline, what does it take to make it all work? And we meet tiny creatures that live inside what's known as Queen's Baths. What can the creatures tell us about a species' resilience to climate change? Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii Tourism Authority board members have been asked by Governor Josh Green to submit courtesy resignations by the end of today. It's part of a restructuring of what was a semi-autonomous agency, which will now become an advisory board and move back under the Department of Business and Economic Development and Tourism. This morning, we talked to Board Chair Todd Apo. HTA has come under fire for procurement violations and failing to pay its vendors, the Hawaii Visitors Bureau and the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, in a timely manner, incurring hundreds of thousands of dollars in interest. It's also grappling with putting a key staffer, Isaac Choi, on leave after allegations of creating a hostile workplace. Apo says he isn't sure if all the board members will submit their courtesy resignations as asked for by the governor.
We got the request Thursday afternoon, and I haven't talked to anyone really about what their plans are. It's all an individual choice. It's not a board action. But I'll say, everyone knew this was likely coming. I have not heard anyone say they were not going to resign. But again, I haven't talked to everyone, and not everyone was in the meeting to share a little bit of their mana'o. So I think we all, including the governor, just got to wait and see.
Okay. And I understand that the governor says that he may reappoint some people just simply because they just got on the board, you know, like yourself, or we're also in this process of trying to select a permanent CEO. And from what I understand, there was a list of, 100 applicants for that position?
Yeah, you know, that happened before my time. I'm still a relatively new board member, and so don't understand all the details of the previous search that happened. But we've talked about using that experience to try to expedite the next step. But, you know, that is really going to be for the next board. And so I think there is value in having some board members continue to bring that connectivity to the next steps. But again, I think with the new law, it clearly put the responsibility in the governor's office. And so I certainly respect and probably agree with the, hey, let's start new. Let's wipe the slate clean, find the right group to help lead HTA into, I think there's a bunch of things that have to happen in the short term. And ultimately, we need to get to the long-term discussion of what should HTA be and how is it going to best serve Hawaii and tourism in Hawaii. And I know you had a little bit of that discussion with the governor last week, and I agree, we need to figure that out.
Well, you know, we're in a situation where you had people in key leadership roles leave the authority, and you've got interim folks in place. But I know there seems to be some concern by lawmakers, that folks might just be inexperienced. And it's really a difficult time. And there's just lots of pressure to fix what's broken, what some people see as broken.
Clearly, things need to get righted in a variety of ways, like you listed, from who's in leadership positions to the makeup of the board. And as we went through the past few months since knowing that what was SB 1571 was passed by the legislature, knowing that this evolution and next step was going to happen, it's hard to set long-term forward progress when you know that change is happening. So I think we need to get through this change quickly. So I appreciate the governor getting this out. I think they have a plan to try to get the new board named quickly. And that's what needs to really move forward, is deal with leadership positions, who's there, who can we find to fill the vacancies? And that's, again, part of that short-term fix that needs to happen for HTA.
Given that this board is moving from a policy board to an advisory board, it's probably going to take a while before, you know, the lines are bright. But I don't know, what's the biggest challenge that you see just in this next month?
And whether it's in the next month or maybe, let's say, next 3 months, I think one of the biggest issues for HTA has been not having a permanent CEO leader. And that's gone on for 2 years. I came in and looking at the situation over the last 6 months, there were some reasons why, but that lack of permanent leadership, I think, really is the starting point for a lot of the issues that are being discussed and need to be dealt with. And so I've continued to push on the fact and talked about this with the legislators last Monday. That's really the priority for, let's call it now, this next board, that in the next month to 3 months, and hopefully within 4 months, a permanent CEO is selected. I think that's what brings stability. That's where someone can start articulating the vision, working with the governor's office, working with the legislators, because part of this is we need to get HTA figured out for a discussion at next year's leg session starting in January. And if we don't have that leader in quickly, it's going to be difficult to get through those discussions to a point of being ready for a ledge opening in January.
Well, I'm scratching my head because I don't understand why, when you have interim leadership, that the process for certain things like procurement, what have you, that all that falls apart. And I just don't know if you don't have key people in positions that are familiar with the laws and, you know, how things are supposed to work. You know, it just seems like a lot of the concern about all the negative headlines in the news has to do with just procedures that weren't followed. So why does everything fall apart?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, from, I don't know. Again, being a relatively new board member, to tell you the truth, over the last 6 months, I've been trying to focus us on how do we fix, whether it's procurement issues or others, how do we fix them as opposed to going back and figuring out why they happened. And I understand we need to go back and figure that out because we want to make sure we're not repeating them. But at least my focus over the last few months has really been about making sure that we fix them. I mean, you've heard the discussion around how what happened in order to get both CNHA and HBCB caught up in their payments. To me, that was the most important first step, is making sure those things got done. And again, we need to get a leader, find the time to make sure, is it a lack of policy and procedure, or was it a failure to follow existing policy and procedure? And again, I don't know. You know, part of what I heard in some of the testimony that was shared last Monday was that probably where a number of those issues arose out of from a personnel side, are those individuals or that group is no longer employed at HTA. So if it was that things just weren't followed, that policies that exist weren't followed, then maybe some of that's been solved. But I think to your point, to everyone's question, those things need to be figured out.
Yes, I mean, you know, lawmakers clearly were dismayed at some of the dysfunction, you know, hearing from the board members, longtime board members, and then also, you know, like yourself, who just stepped in and seemed to be caught in the crossfire about what's your kuleana exactly and how do we get out of this mess?
And I think it's that combination. We're a voluntary board, and I'm not able to be there. As a voluntary board member, I'm not sitting in the HTA offices on a daily basis at 8 hours a day. And so you rely on the team that's there, and it's a great team, but they're stretched. There are people in positions because of the vacancies that are filling multiple roles. And again, that's what needs to get solved. We need to fill those vacancies. We need to get the ship in the right position with the right crew so it can start performing as it should be. And I think it can. I have full confidence that HTA has an authority with the individuals that are there and supplementing them with new hires can take care of business in the right way. We need to move on to those steps.
Do you plan to submit your courtesy resignation? And will you ask to come back if the governor reappoints you?
So I will be turning in my resignation. As I said, I believe that's completely within the governor's call. And I think it may be better someday to allow him to be able to require those. But it's a new step. I will resign. I'll have a conversation with governor and his team. Part of my I've said to them a bit is, if I can help, I'm glad to help. But I'm also, it's a voluntary board. I don't want to just be spinning wheels and fighting headwinds. But if we're really trying to find and work towards solutions and we feel like we can get there together, I'm glad to see how I can help.
And the board is or has been talking about a strategic plan. They've been talking about a new governance plan. Any ideas just in the 6 months that you've been there as to where that goes?
Yeah, I think both the strategic plan and the other DMAP processing is in process to get going. Consultants are hired to help set a strategic plan. We need a new one. Our current strategic plan ends at the end of this year. If you put all the noise that's been going on aside, I think that strategic plan is another very important step for HTA. So certainly, and I'm pretty confident that this next board will focus on that with staff, because that strategic plan is really going to guide how we move forward. And when you look at HTA, our tourism overall in Hawaii, the community impact, the destination management that's being combined, this new strategic plan really needs to take what's happened within those areas over the past, I'll put it even post-COVID, and develop a new strategy and plan for what we want tourism to be in Hawaii. And so I think it's a really important time to get through that new strategic plan for HTA.
Okay. Anything else that you want to underscore just from the last couple of weeks? Because it's been brutal.
Yeah. I mean, the last thing I'll say is the questions are the questions. They need to get solved both from a strategy and foundational aspect, but also from a daily operations aspect. But the big picture bottom line that I've said, it's going to take time, but we need to get to it, is how does HTA best function in the long term? You know, it's easy to react to some of the issues and make what may be drastic changes in different directions. And I understand those need to happen to fix where we are now. But I also think everyone needs to step back and make sure we take a little bit more objective, long-term view of what's best for tourism and for Hawaii and our communities relative to tourism. And so sort of get out of a frenzy at some point and take a good, solid look at things. And both those things need to happen. It's going to take time to evolve through that.
Yeah, so just take a deep breath and then start anew July 1st and see how fast we can fix what's broken.
Yeah, yes.
Do you have any meetings set up with the governor this week?
Nothing set up at this point. I got to get my resignation in today, and we'll take next steps after that.
Okay. All right. Well, Tata Poe, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Great talking with you. Thanks so much, Catherine.
All right.
Aloha.
That was Hawaii Tourism Authority Chair Tata Poe talking to us earlier this morning. Again, he said at this point he has no meeting set with Governor Green. Stay tuned to see what happens next.
Looking for cool, unique experiences and events happening across our Hawaiian Islands? Let your new HPR besties show you the way. Introducing HPR's Social Club newsletter. Every Wednesday, get the latest happenings straight to your inbox. Sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org/socialclub.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
The National Suicide Prevention Hotline has fielded more than 10 million calls since it was implemented about 3 years ago. Well, over a million of those calls have come from individuals who identify as LGBTQ. Members of that community have had a dedicated line to connect with individuals trained to help them in their time of crisis. But the Trump administration recently announced plans to do away with that program. Here to talk about that is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning, Cassie.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so not good news here.
No, so starting July 17th, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Human Services, announced on July 17th they will no longer silo services, which is a press 3 option for the 988 crisis hotline for LGBTQ+. But in a statement from that agency, they actually said they won't silo services for LGB+. They left out T and Q, which stand for trans and queer. That was an interesting statement from what advocates have said. And advocates in Hawaii, they are worried because there is already a lack of gender-affirming resources locally, and cuts to that federally funded service could lead to severe consequences. And just a little bit of background on that 988 suicide hotline, it actually launched in 2005. And before, the call used to be 1-800-273-TALK. They didn't have those options for veterans or LGBTQ+ individuals who are at higher risk of suicide and depression.
So it was streamlined then.
Yeah, it was streamlined. And in 2022, that's when the agency launched the 988 crisis. So they turned it into a 3-digit number instead. And so they have individual options where veterans or even LGBTQ+ individuals can get help from a certain counselor who's trained specially for them. And so LGBTQ+, it's been well documented. So suicide is a leading cause for death of Native Hawaiians and LGBTQ+ youth from ages 15 to 24. That's according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And the CDC also reported that 41% of LGBTQ+ youth in the U.S. have considered suicide. So that's higher than their straight cisgender peers. And while it's important to note that LGBTQ+ youth are at high risk for suicide, it's not inherently because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Instead, advocates say they're at higher risk because of how they're mistreated and stigmatized in society. That's also according to the Trevor Project, which is a national nonprofit with a mission to end suicide among LGBTQ+ youth. And I actually talked to some folks in the community. Miles Dunn, he's 19, he's a transgender man. He says that dedicated services are essential for the LGBTQ+ community, and removing those services could be dire.
It's honestly really worrying because of the type of service that is. That's people's lives. Those are people who are literally considering taking their own lives. And there's still the hotline. There's still people to help with people who are struggling with mental health issues. But the thing is, being queer, any part of the queer community, it comes with its own very unique challenges that some mental health people aren't equipped to handle. In my own experience in the mental health treatment and all of that, there were many times where I felt asking to have my identity respected, or just even being myself while still getting treatment, it felt like a burden for them. And it made me open up less. And so with this taking that option away, you're not allowing people to get the proper help that they need, because a lot of people struggle with mental health issues. Every type of person struggles with them. Even people who are anti-queer people still struggle with mental health issues. And those type of people might want to help other people who struggle with mental health issues. But if someone like that is on just a general hotline, and a queer kid calls and is talking about their issues, and their queer identity might play a big part in that, and most of the time does, that person is either not going to know how to respond, or respond in a way that is detrimental to that person's life. So it's so important to have something that's specialized for queer people so that they don't have to worry about feeling like a burden.
And Hawaii is considered an LGBTQ+ friendly state, but community members and advocates say it's still a struggle for that community to get gender affirming care, which is including mental health services available therapists. And I spoke with Halen Dennison, who is the executive director and founder of Spill the Tea Cafe, which is an Oahu based mental health advocacy, and they provide therapists for many kids in the LGBTQ plus community and the youth. She said that in Hawaii, the state is the least resource with just one licensed therapist for every 360 kids, and the overall wait time is a four-month wait time. So that's a long time.
That's terrible because you're in a crisis mode, and you have to wait that long for help.
Exactly. And Denison talks about, you know, what can lead a child to feeling depressed or suicidal.
The bottom line is that every one of these kids are different. They're wired differently, and there's assumptions made about them. And so having that early on can contribute to feeling like loss of connection, right? Getting bullied, feeling like this world is not meant for me, feeling like I'm in the wrong body, right? Feeling like if I come out, my parents will disown me or my church will, right? Like, so all of these kind of thoughts and fears can cause anxiety within a child. And then furthermore, feeling like exhausted and that I guess if I can be transparent, I've worked with hundreds of these teens and I have not met any kid yet that like really, really wants to be trans. What I'm saying is that they have a hard time accepting themselves. And so once they do and they find the courage to kind of tell someone that they trust and say a parent reacts poorly like the way I did, then, you know, it can cause a sense of isolation and like I don't belong for the child. And so these are the things that kind of contribute to feeling depressed and then feeling suicidal.
And while the Spill the Tea Cafe, they have trained counselors for LGBTQ plus youth, Denison said that the nonprofit is bracing for an influx of calls and has actually experienced an influx of calls. But you also look at the Trevor Project, which is the national organization that has their own like a separate crisis hotline, but they're also one of the contacts and contracts for the 988 crisis calls, and they actually received a little bit more than half of the 988 crisis calls directed towards the Trevor Project. The Trevor Project also reported that the day after the 2024 elections, there was a 700% spike in the overall call volume of crisis contacts compared to weeks prior. And Surav Thapa is a senior federal affairs manager at the Trevor Project. He said the nonprofit has launched a petition regarding the 988 hotline.
There's something called the Mental Health Liaison Group, MHLG. That's a coalition of over 100 national mental health organizations. And they've come on board very strongly supporting a sign-on letter where we're calling on bipartisan champions for LGBTQ mental health in Congress, which is a lot of members and senators, to push back against this administration. Because Congress has the power of the purse. They get to decide what gets spent and how it gets spent. So we're really pushing Congress to stand up for this program and make sure that it's fully funded in FY26, which starts on October 1st. So that's one piece. There is also I know there are some members of Congress, of the U.S. Congress, that are looking into other options, such as making sure that language for 988 LGBTQ youth services is put into the funding bill for next fiscal year. Because that was not the case in the past. It was Senate report language. I'm not going to get into the details now, but it was not in the actual law, but it was like additional language from the Senate. Now, what we really want to do is make sure that Congress puts the language in the law. So when the president signs it, you know, this is guaranteed.
Yeah, so lots of uncertainty ahead.
And so the LGBTQ plus community, they are hoping that the gender-affirming care providers can handle and brace for these influx of calls when in need.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie. That was Cassie Ordonio talking about the Trump administration's decision to shut down a suicide prevention line dedicated to the LGBTQ community. You can read more about her story at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Help wanted?
You want to sort of think about a young college graduate like a capital investment. And so when businesses are feeling confident about investments overall, they tend to hire more college graduates. And when they're feeling less confident, they hire fewer.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the new grad job bust. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Sand dunes are one of nature's best defenses against strong waves and even tsunamis, but beaches across the islands are losing their dunes to erosion and unmanaged foot traffic. A project on the Valley Isle is relying on native plants to shore up dunes and fortify the beaches. Jenna Spellman works with the Maui County Parks and Recreation in a one-of-a-kind role. She oversees dune crews, groups of volunteers who work on shoreline restoration and maintenance. The plants used in the restoration efforts come from a nursery that's maintained by the county. The nursery is currently cultivating more than 30 native plant species, and since it opened a year ago, the nursery has propagated more than 3,000 native plants. About 1,000 of these plants have already been used for shoreline restoration. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson talked with Spellman about the program.
So the nursery itself it's not a super big program yet. We're only about a year old. We grow out native plants, mostly for shoreline restoration, but also for other park needs. We source them from a couple different places. We get donations from Maui Nui Botanical Garden, who are our neighbors. And not only do they help me with plant material, but they also help a ton with plant knowledge. We purchase plants from the native nursery. We get plants from just citizens that are passionate about native plants. And then we do collect plants from the land itself. We never take more than 10% of any plant or any population. So we'll source the plant material, which means taking little cuttings and bringing them back to the nursery. And then it's kind of funny because the nursery is literally a nursery. We take babies and we grow them into plants that are viable and can go back out into the environment. We just kind of give them a leg up. And that looks quite often like providing some irrigation. And the irrigation is not forever. It's a temporary stopgap just to kind of baby them for a little bit. So we water them usually on average about 5 months before we pull the irrigation all together and set them free. We will still after that maintain weeding. And once they get to a certain size and height or length, they can usually sustain on their own. Our nursery is open air. So we do face challenges of wind. You can't control the wind. And if anyone grows on the islands, they know that our pest pressure is formidable. The insect cycle is never broken. There is so many fungus here and everything likes to eat the plants. So we have made a commitment to grow as naturally as possible. We don't really do chemical intervention. I haven't actually had a situation yet where I've had to, and I've lost up to 80% of my material to like a white rust. It's heartbreaking at times, but there's this sweet benefit to not saving your plants when they're babies, to letting them die. You have to keep them alive to a certain extent, but you build resiliency into them if you nurture them a little bit more with tough love than true babying.
Tell us about these opportunities to do the coastline restoration and the dune crews, as I think you call them. Tell us about that work and what it looks like.
The program was designed to address a need basically for maintenance of these shoreline restoration projects, because everyone was all excited about putting the plants in, but then there was really no support system in place to support the plants once they got there. And if you don't do anything to support them, you'll have weeds back in 2 weeks. So that was the point of this. And it is that. It's grown to be maybe a little bit more than that. Shorelines are tricky. There's federal agencies, there's state agencies, there's county agencies, there's within the county, there's permitting, there's all sorts of checks and balances to make sure you're doing the right thing in the right place with the right people. So that is a ton of the work and it takes a lot of cooperation. Once we have a site, there's environmental impact studies, there are community outreach meetings where we get people's feedback on things. And because it's parks, you know, it's multiple uses. And the truth is, I don't think it's too hard for people to get behind shoreline restoration. Putting native plants back in the ground to their home, to where they're meant to be, is a no-brainer in my book. But people like using the parks for different things, and it can be challenging to align all of those. So you got to wrangle with all of that. But once those decisions are made and everything's in place, we will go to the site and basically assess it, see what the ground looks like. I definitely operate on the principle of right plant, right place. But that being said, I'm not looking to scalp a shoreline just because this plant wasn't originally from here. Like every plant does a job. Some just do it better than others. And like a 10,000 foot view, our job is kind of massaging that zone to remove the plants that maybe don't do the exact job that nature needs them to do and put in the plants that do. So we will set up sand fencing, if appropriate, to help catch sand for sand dune restoration. We will put in temporary irrigation, which looks like drip lines most commonly, or drip tape, and make a planting plan for what plants are going to go where. And we have an idea of what plants we're going to work with, but we pay close attention to the surrounding environment and see who is succeeding and who isn't succeeding. And sometimes we get it right, and sometimes we get it somewhat right. We listen to the ocean. She tells us things, you know, like these plants don't belong here, or they do. So the prep for the planting day is setting up for volunteers, all of the things that humans need for support, hoping the weather and the tides cooperate. We'll have the volunteers come in, and I usually let them have free rein of what plant goes where. I call it the Hawaiian tapestry. And the idea being that these plants do all work well together, but they'll fill in different spots in the area. So one may grow a little bit taller, or one may be stronger at growing underground, and the other one covers the surface. When you do the planting, it's not super beautiful necessarily that first day, but then watching them through the process and then keeping foot traffic out of the area is really important. We say paths, perimeters, and plants are the three P's for the restoration area. You can do a surprising amount of restoration work just by getting people on pathways. We do trample, and it does affect processing, especially when you're talking about grains of sand collecting and plants growing. I mean, we don't grow the sand dune. The sand dune grows itself, you know, the plants, and sometimes the sand fencing, we give it a leg up, but the plants catch the sand. And what I think is really fascinating about our shoreline plants, our native plants for the shoreline, is they have really specific and unique growth patterns and root patterns that allow sand to come and go. So I think a lot of people have the idea that you want your plants facing the ocean to be like a green hard wall, but that's not the case at all. You actually want a really soft approach. You think of the sand in a sand dune as like a bank deposit for the ocean, where it can put sand in, but it can also take sand away. And the plants that belong there can handle that. They actually thrive on it. You can put sand on their head and they'll dig their way out. You can pull sand out from underneath them and they'll slide down with it. And if you ever observe sand dunes, like, that's what the plants are doing. So, you know, we have the akiaki grass. Its stolons, its underground organ, will be like 3 feet underground, goes really deep, but it never forms like a super tight mesh. It's just kind of thready, so the sand can come and go. The akulikuli, which is like a little succulent in the purslane family, it forms a net on the ground, but it's salt tolerant. It is wind tolerant. It doesn't mind the sun. You can dry it out. It'll come back to life. It's a really durable, adorable little plant with these beautiful purple flowers. And it's made for this zone. It might even get moisture from the atmosphere. Like, it is salt ready, sand ready. And the pohoihoi is the one that most people are familiar with. It's the broadleaf with the really purple flower. It's our native morning glory. And if you've seen it grow, it just stretches its legs out. And you can totally envision how that lets sand come and go without being a problem. The plants are brilliant. They're really smart. They've figured it out. We're just trying to steward them along the way.
All of those details are so fascinating. It makes it obvious why these native plants are the ones to put there. They're the ones that can succeed in this environment. But also, too, these plants succeed at interacting with other forms of life in terms of creating habitats.
Absolutely. Native flora and fauna evolve together. So our native plants are the cornerstone and the foundation of a native environment. You have insects and birds and bees and bats, that these are both their habitat and their preferred food. And on the negative side of things, like, as those habitats diminish, there's less and less space for the animals to live. Helping to restore natural habitat has repercussions for our watershed, for our shorefronts, for our animals. I mean, it's an ecosystem. It is a whole system-wide event. It's, you know, I joke around and say that, you know, planting this plant isn't going to save the world. But the truth is, it's a great start.
you've been able to watch the growth. And you spoke to that a little bit more, but say more about that in terms of the success or the challenges you've seen as you've seen the plantings mature.
One of our plantings that has gotten the most spotlight and most press because it's been kind of big on the island was a beach we call Baldwin Beach. Kapuka Ulua is the name of the area. And there was a pavilion there that finally collapsed into the ocean last year. And where that stood, we called it a pilot planting, but we put a planting right in its place, like pretty much pronto. So it has been more than 50% successful in that the plants that have survived have done great. But during the winter is our big wave time at that beach. And that was known when we put the planting in. We very much knew that we were doing it right before the big swells were going to come in. And every time I get the surf warning, you know, like my blood pressure would go up. You know, the plants, again, they're designed to take a little bit, you know, they can take some waves on, they can sustain, they can tolerate. There was the one big surge wave set that came through when they had the Eddie Acau, and not just the beach took waves, like the whole park did, the parking lot, the bathrooms, like, I mean, everything was flooded, you know, so that did educate our planting. We wound up kind of heeding not just the advice from that one storm event, but from the events before, because we get washover about every 2 or 3 weeks, and some of the plants were thriving and some were not. What I think is kind of cool is that some of the plants that were out at the spot that got totally overwashed by the ocean were buried under 3 feet of sand. So you're like, bye plants. But some of them have found their way back to the surface. And these plants are completely unsupported at this point. They don't have any irrigation. I'm not protecting them from anything. They're just on their own. But from the depths of the sand, they've kept alive and made their way up. And now they live there now. And it's so encouraging as someone who takes care of these plants. It makes me feel better when I do pull the irrigation, like they're going to be okay. And they're survivors. They really belong there. And it's great to see. And as we move on with other plantings in the area, which is our plan, you know, we'll listen to the lessons of the ocean when she says this is too close or this is too far, and be responsive to the feedback that we get from all of the community.
The volunteers who come to help with the plantings, what do you think it is that motivates them to come out? And what do you think it is that they take away from the experience?
People care, you know? There is a heart there that I can't teach someone or train someone. And that's what makes people show up. Maybe they're a surfer, maybe they're a diver, maybe they're just a beachgoer, and they have seen erosion. They've seen things fall into the water. They've seen these processes, and it's easy to feel helpless. So when presented with an opportunity that says, hey, we have something you can do, you know, we have something you can actually do. You can come with us and put this plant on the ground. We can all work together. Everyone can get behind a native plant. It's not ownership. It's like stewardship. The heart connection that someone has, like I put that plant there, it resonates. And I feel it. There's a connection there that is undeniable.
That was Jenna Spellman talking about her work as the supervisor of the Dune Cruise, restoring and maintaining shorelines on Maui.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, architects dedicated to creating learning environments across Hawaii's educational institutions. FerraroChoi.com.
The big picture is we have a president who's quite happy with the Supreme Court. So we see a kind of close relationship between the president and the Supreme Court, with the president claiming unprecedented powers for himself, and the court not only not standing in his way, but generally opening the door.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from PAR Hawaii, committed to meeting the energy needs of Hawaii and supporting community nonprofit organizations across the islands. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
Heard of the Ecosphere, which was a sealed glass aquarium containing soft coral algae, and the star of the show was a tiny red shrimp. That creature was a Hawaiian volcano shrimp, or opaiula, and scientists have been studying these creatures to learn how species might adapt to climate change. That's because volcano shrimp live in ankylosing ecosystems, which is warm water pockets formed by ponds or cracks in lava. Justin Havard is a biology professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about these shrimp, starting with a ghost story.
There is a legend associated with one of them on Maui called a Waianapanapa Cave. The story goes that there was this jealous Maui prince, and the princess ran away to escape him or whatever, and she went and hid in this cave, which is an ankylosing pond, and he saw her reflection in the water somehow, and he got her and killed her. But the legend is that, you know, on certain days, the shrimp come out of this cave, like, in mass, and kind of turns the water red with blood. And that's the reminder of sort of the slain princess and her blood and things like that. We've gone snorkeling in the back of that cave to do surveys for shrimp and stuff like that, because unfortunately that's one of the habitats that's like really been impacted by invasive mosquito fish. So you can't see the shrimp unless you go there at night when the fish kind of go to sleep. But we've snorkeled in the back of that cave where the princess was supposedly killed, which is really creepy. But the shrimp are still in the back of the cave, and sort of the fish hang out in the lighted area, and then the shrimp have been segregated to the dark back of the cave. So it is a really fun sight, but yeah, very cold and very creepy.
Yeah. So these shrimp are broadly important and interesting, but let's focus on why they're interesting to you in this study, thinking about plasticity. Could you give a primer on that to a non-scientific audience?
Sure. So, you know, organisms can respond to their environment kind of in two different ways. One is on a short term. So within an organism's lifestyle, it can change in response to the environment. So if we were to go to the gym and lift weights, we would get bigger muscles, for example. But we wouldn't necessarily pass on those changes to our offspring. Like, our kids would not be born with bigger muscles because we lifted weights. So that change within an organism's lifestyle is called plasticity. So, you know, we see this whenever people live at higher elevations, and after a few weeks, you know, they're able to run better and breathe easier at those elevations and things like that. The other way that organisms can change in response to environmental change is through genetic change or adaptation. So yeah, it's always interesting to think about how organisms will respond to climate change through those two mechanisms. You know, is there strong enough selection on genetics, and is the genetic variation there so that they can sort of adapt to a warmer world or a more acidic world, if we're talking about marine organisms, over several generations? Or can they kind of make do with some of these short-term changes that act directly on single organisms?
To go back to the weightlifting metaphor, it's like, are some people, if they hit the gym for 2 weeks, more poised to become bodybuilders?
Yeah, that's right. There's some genetic variation to how much muscle you can put on with gym environments as well.
So you looked at two different populations of volcano shrimp, right? One in kind of this newer, warmer climate formed by the 2018 Kilauea eruption, and then another in a cooler, but still, I imagine, warm part of the water. And so what'd you find?
one of the main comparisons we made were between shrimp that are found in these new habitats that were created in 2018, and they've continued to have elevated temperatures ever since they were created. So this is on the order of like a super warm bath. It's around 40 degrees Celsius, which is pretty warm for these habitats. And we compared those to animals from older habitats that were created hundreds or thousands of years ago. And on average, those are around 25 degrees Celsius, which is about room temperature. So these habitats are, you know, another reason that people enjoy them is because they are relatively cool, especially when they're in these barren lava fields. They're kind of like little oases where there's fresh water and there's like a nice place to swim. And we found that a lot of the differences that we saw between the shrimp that we were looking at in the field when we just went and collected them straight from their habitats could be explained by them getting acclimated to these warmer temperatures. So we didn't see a ton of genetic differences. We didn't see a lot of evidence that the shrimp that are from these hot habitats had been selected to be in the hot habitats, that they could deal with increased temperatures better. But, you know, if we take shrimp from those cooler habitats and sort of gradually increase the temperature that they're at in the lab, then they can also deal with these warmer temperatures more or less okay.
And then take that to the next level of what that could mean when we're thinking about something as massive as how species adapt to climate change.
Yeah, so it's always a big goal of climate change biologists now to predict like who's going to be the winners and who's going to be the losers under climate change, right? Some species are going to be able to do okay. Some species are going to adapt or move into new habitats and sort of deal with it. And then others are just going to get wiped out and go extinct. So we wanted to know, you know, number one, whether or not as a species there was genetic variation for some of these thermally linked traits. We did find a little support for that. So if we look across populations of shrimp from across all the islands, there was some differences in different genetic lineages of how they responded to increased temperatures, and then also their sort of baseline metabolic rate, which is just how much energy they consumed at room temperature. And that's a pretty important physiological trait that can be linked to a lot of adaptive changes. So we did find a little bit of genetic variation, which is good because it suggests that as a species, there may be some variation for selection to act on. But then again, we found that for some traits, there was this big plastic response suggesting that they can maybe go with the flow in terms of climate change and they'll just be okay. But there was also this response where basically the shrimp that are living in those hot ponds right now, they're kind of living at their maximum temperature. They can't take it any hotter. And we see this in the lab, and then we also have seen it in some of those newer hot ponds out in the field, because there are some that have gotten a little bit warmer over time versus some that have gotten a little bit cooler. And the ones that have gotten a little bit cooler have shrimp populations. The ones that have gotten a little bit warmer don't. So we think we've actually seen some evidence from that site over near Kilauea, where increased temperatures are already driving shrimp either underground maybe where it's cooler or just, extirpating them from those habitats overall.
How are the shrimp getting to these pockets of warm water in the first place?
One way to think about these habitats is that they're kind of like little windows that are looking down into the aquifer. And there's probably millions and millions of shrimp that are down in the aquifer that we're like walking on all the time when we're walking around the coast of these islands. So these shrimp, you know, often are down in the aquifer, and then whenever a new habitat is created, they might eventually colonize it if the habitat has the right sort of set of environmental characteristics. You know, we found in this study that if it's too hot, then they're probably not going to colonize it. But if the temperature is right and the oxygen levels are right and they have, you know, maybe something to graze on there, then after a while, the shrimp will kind of pop up in those habitats.
What other sorts of questions do you have about volcano shrimp? Like, what else is your lab investigating?
Oh man, we do all sorts of things with these shrimp. So they have a soft spot in my heart. They're just really fun. They're charismatic. We have another study that's ongoing right now that's kind of beefing up the genetics of the species. So we hypothesize, based on these studies that happened about 20 years ago, that again, there is this genetic variation across the species, and there are these distinct lineages on different parts of different islands. And some people have even said that they might be like different species, that we shouldn't be calling it the same species across the islands. And that has a ton of implications for conservation, right? Some of these lineages are only known from like one habitat, and if that habitat gets lost, then we don't have access to that species ever again. So we're using some updated genomic techniques to see whether or not those earlier studies hold up to a little more scrutiny, and we're finding some really interesting things. We're finding that in general, there is this really strong population structure where we do have these distinct lineages across the different islands. So that's really cool, and maybe there's even more than we had thought of previously. But we're also finding that these things are probably not separate species. They can probably interbreed with each other, but they just don't come into contact with each other enough that they're able to form these hybrid zones, and they seem like more like little distinct pockets. We're following up on a study that we did a while back looking at coloration across these genetic lineages. So we found that, you know, they're these little red shrimp, but in some lineages, they're really red, and in other lineages, they're like almost clear. But, you know, other organisms utilize other parts of the light spectrum, right? So one of the things we're looking at is if these shrimp autofluoresce. So basically, do they give off their own kind of wavelengths of light, especially like UV light? And we're finding that, yeah, they really do, but it also seems to vary with the lineage. So whether or not that's like due to some adaptive thing where they can see each other or find each other, or whether or not that's just some evolutionary noise, we don't know yet. We're also doing a ton of work on the microbes that live in these habitats. So using some interesting sequencing methods to describe them a little more fully, and then also figuring out kind of what their metabolic capacities are. Like, could these microbes be important in sort of like carbon cycling or nitrogen fixing, things like that. So we've got a lot of work going on in this system, which is super fun.
Anything else that you want listeners to know about this work or this study?
This work definitely could not have been possible without scientific funding. And I think it's important to mention right now how important scientific funding is. This kind of a study might not seem to have any direct applications right now. It's what we call basic research, but the next generation might find something really interesting in it that could be useful for human health, or, you know, they might find a good way to conserve these kind of habitats or these kind of organisms based on what we've done. So yeah, call your congresspeople and tell them how important it is to maintain scientific funding.
That was biologist Justin Havard from the University of Texas at Austin talking with HVR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to the new research about Hawaiian volcano shrimp on our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about funding cuts that affect the future of astronomy and research that's underway at Hawaii-based telescopes. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.